If you've got your Bibles, would you turn with me to, John chapter 4, the fourth chapter of the book of John again. John chapter 4 is we're working our way through this most interesting and my almost eccentric gospel, the gospel of John. Many layers to his teaching, and we are most privileged to be able to walk through it again as we continue our journey this morning. When I went to college, which was Trinity Western College at the time, now Trinity Western University, I'm dating myself. At the time, it was only a junior college, and there were 400 students. It has grown significantly since then. JD and I paid a visit to see Jake Krause there a couple of weeks ago for lunch. Oh, by the way, just a little way of just a brief announcement. Jake will be coming on here this summer as a part-time intern, and so we're looking forward to that and having him serve in a. He'll get a taste for what pastoral life is about. All right, so I'm not sure what we'll all get him to do, but there's a bunch of stuff that we'll put on the docket, and you'll see him a lot more this summer. But anyway, just a little heads up on that. But we went to visit. Now, how was I going to Trinity Western College? Where was I going with that? I'm dating myself, yes. I don't even know how that fits. Anyways, I lost it. But anyways, it's not in my notes. Number of years ago, and I don't know how I connected the dots, but a number of years ago, my brother was in the water business. Oh, I know I was going to connect the dots. When I went to Trinity, they had water fountains there, and they were the most horrible water you ever tasted in your life. And so that was the connection on this one. But, oh, the water was bad. I don't know if it's improved there since, but it was not good water. Anyway, my brother was also at one time in the water business. He would sell bottled water at the time that it was sort of emerging. It was kind of an odd thing for me because, I grew up on a farm. And you wanted a drink of water, you went to the hose at the back and you turned it on. It was from the well. It was good, refreshing cold water. But I suppose people now, when he was in the business, wanted nice, clean, refreshing drinking water. And so he was in that business. And as I started thinking about it, oh, now I know also how I was connecting the dots to Trinity Western. It's just random. When I started there, and back to the beginning of the sermon, just disconnect the dots from everything I've said to this point. When I started there, my major was biochemistry. And that doesn't make me very smart. It just sounded impressive. I was actually on the pre-med track when I started in college and made a change down the road, and that's a whole other story. But one of the things that we learned in taking chemistry classes was that water, as we talked about different substances, water was a very unusual substance. I don't know if you're aware of that, but water is not a normal kind of, doesn't have normal properties that other substances have. Although it is a very important makeup of life. Water makes up to 90% of the total capacity of some organisms. 60% of your body is water. So when we say you're all washed up, that's literally true. 73% of your brain is water. 83% of your lungs are composed of water. It has enormous capacity. It is a part of what makes life work on this earth. Some of the interesting properties of water, though, that make it so unusual, you see it every year. In the middle of winter, if you go to a pond, you see it probably more so on the prairies, but you're able to go ice skating because of the unusual properties of water. I don't know if you understand that. Because most substances, when they are solid, are at their densest point. And so if water had normal properties, the ice would be at the bottom of the lake, not at the top. Water at its densest is at 4 degrees Celsius. So it's just a very interesting kind of substance. It is a solid that is less dense than the liquid. It has an unusually high boiling point. And so a scientist would tell us that if water behaved normally, life couldn't exist. Which I think is another, if you want to go down that road, another evidence in my understanding just for the existence of God, that he would create this most unusual substance. And if that substance was not unusual, you wouldn't be here today. But if you want to do more study on water, you can go online and do some digging on it. It's a fascinating substance. Well, that becomes the topic of this morning's message. Water. I don't know if you, that's why you came to church, is to learn a little bit about water, but that's going to be the sermon this morning. Not a biology lesson per se, but a spiritual lesson. As we want to talk about living water, spiritual water, water for your soul. And so we've come to John chapter 4 in a very familiar passage to those who have any background in church. If you don't, it may be new to you, but it is among the Christian church a familiar passage that Jesus encounters with a Samaritan woman at a well. And although it's familiar, I hope this morning as we have a conversation about this that you will glean something from it. Maybe there's something new here this morning that you didn't know before as we talk about a passage that is, I would say, deep. It has great profundity to it. And it causes us to think a little bit, and especially in terms of the context and the world in which we live. And so John chapter 4, we're going to read the first 26 verses. We won't get to the whole story with Jesus at this well, but the first half this morning. John chapter 4, reading from verse 1. Now when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Now, Jacob's well was there, so Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour. A woman from Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water, so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." Jesus said to her, "Go, call your husband and come here." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one that you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. The woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things. And Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. Living water. Two sections that I would draw to your attention in this morning's text as we examine this theme of living water. And before we look into it, and just a question that I will end with is, have you had a drink? Or maybe more accurately, are you drinking from the living water? Two things. First of all, I would have you see the circumstances which brought Jesus to this well of water. The circumstances which brought Jesus to a well of water. And there are three things I would draw to your attention. First of all, is a problem with the Pharisees that begins his trek to this well. A problem with the Pharisees. Verse 1, when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize but only his disciples, he left Galilee and departed again. Judea and departed again for Galilee. For the religious leaders, and this is where we left off last week, this baptism that Jesus is performing is a bit of a bother. Or you can read that into the text, most likely. John had been baptizing, and last week we saw how Jesus had also now begun not far away been baptizing himself. And John's disciples didn't like this too much. They thought Jesus was a bit of a competition, and so they come running to John, and John says, no deal, he must increase, but I must decrease. If they're coming to Jesus, that's why I have come, so bring them on. I'm good with this. This now becomes a bit of a backdrop for the religious leaders who are also aware of the fact that Jesus is attracting a crowd. We saw back in chapter 1 that they came to John and said, what gives you authority for you to baptize all the people? What are you about here? They're already getting a little bit nervous, but now that they see even more people coming to Jesus, they're even probably more apprehensive. And Jesus becomes aware of this. And so he decides he's not going to stay here, he's going to leave. And so this is the sort of the thing that is instrumental in his leaving the area now and heading back up to Galilee in the north. If John was a problem, Jesus was more of a problem. And perhaps now he senses this danger. Now it does clarify in verse 2 that he's actually not the one doing the baptizing, it's his disciples. But no matter, he's the head of this new baptismal organization that the Pharisees, the religious leaders, do not like. I would have you note, and this is true throughout the Gospel of John, that Jesus is always in control. And John will talk about this repeatedly, his hour has not yet come. His reason for coming, the crucifixion, his betrayal, his death on a cross, that time has not yet come. His ministry is only beginning. He controls his destiny, not any religious leader. And so he's not afraid, he's not scared of what they might do to him. He just knows that it's not time yet, and so it's an opportunity for him now to move out of this area. The work of baptizing in Judea is complete, and now he's moving on. And I would have you know, whether it's here or whether it's in our lives or within our own culture, that Jesus always controls the agenda. He's in charge. He knows what's going on. And he will do things when he jolly well pleases. We have the illusion of being in control, of thinking we're going to move the post around so that the things go the way we want them to go. But God is in control. He's in complete charge of everything, not man. And we see that now as Jesus moves on from here. So a problem with the Pharisees sets this wheel in motion. Two, I would have you see in verse 4, the purpose in his travels. The purpose in his travels. It says, and he had to pass through Samaria on his way up to Galilee. Now, if you are a bit of a student of biblical history, historical understanding of Jewish culture at the time, you will realize as you read that verse that that's not true. You don't have to pass through Samaria to go to Galilee. In fact, most good Jews did not pass through Samaria to go to Galilee. So what's this about? He had to pass through Samaria. Most Jews would have gone around Samaria, up the Jordan River Valley, and then into Galilee. Because, as we will see in just a little bit, Samaria is not a place that you wanted to go. It was an unclean place. There were a bunch of half-breeds there, and we don't want to have any dealings with those people. They went around Samaria. These are the despised people. They accused Jesus in John chapter 8 of being a Samaritan. And then they accused him of having a demon. This is, it's like swearing at him. Vulgar language to call someone a Samaritan. I'm not sure we even have equivalent kinds of terminology. I guess we do in sort of racial kinds of slang that people might use. That's the idea here. See, an idea of what they thought of Samaria. More of that in just a moment. But he had to. Not physically, but spiritually. Again, we see that Jesus is always in control. He had a purpose. He had an agenda. He came for a reason. And nothing would deter him from that. Not some cultural faux pas, not some societal norm, not some racial bigotry. Nothing stops him from doing what he was called to do. He's going through Samaria. We would see later on in his life that he says that he set his face squarely for Jerusalem to face his own death. Jesus is controlling the agenda, and this was now his purpose. He needed to go through Samaria because there was someone in Samaria that he had his eyes on. And isn't that neat? He went through Samaria for one lady and ultimately her family and the city that she was connected with. Jesus is always looking and heading for people, and sometimes people you would never expect. And maybe he's come across your path like that. You'd never expect that he would ever have said, oh, I'm doing this in your life because that's my purpose right now. So he had to go through Samaria, the purpose in his travels. Thirdly, I would have you see the place where he rested in verses 5 and 6. The place where he rested. It says he comes to a place called Sychar. It has Jewish roots. It tells us a little bit about the history. We're not going to go back to Genesis this morning. I don't have time for that. You can read the story at home if you want of how this land was acquired. It talks a little bit about the details here. Jacob's well is there. It was given later on to Joseph. So there's deep Jewish history in this part of the world. And there's a well that was dug that is still in existence some, 2,000 years later, this well in Sychar. Sychar, the commentators are divided in terms of what the name of the city means. The Hebrew word sheker means falsehood, and shekar means liquor. So maybe there's some analogies that this is kind of a wicked place. And it's Samaria, that the term is related to a bunch of lying drunkards, right? It gives you the creeps when you think about this part of the world. And that's the point. It's kind of scuzzy. This place that started so good when this well was dug is now not so cool. Sychar. So Jesus comes there to this well as he's going through Samaria. He's tired and he sits down by the well. It says a little later on in verse 8, disciples had gone into town to buy some food. Doesn't say why he doesn't go along, but he's sitting by the well. It says it's the sixth hour. Now, most commentators would suggest that this is 12 o'clock. It's noon. I'm not sure. If you do a bit of a chronological study in the book of John with respect to his use of time, it may very well be, and there's some who would suggest it's not noon, but what John is using is Roman time here, and it may well be that it's 6 o'clock in the evening. So you can do your own homework. It doesn't ultimately make a massive difference in terms of our interpretation of this text, but typically women didn't come to draw water at noon. You would have come in the evening. And it would have made more sense for the disciples to go into town to get something to eat in evening. Typically, stores wouldn't even have been opened at noon in that part of the world at that time. And if you look at the other references to time in John, it may very well be that he's using Roman time and it's 6 o'clock in the evening. So the woman coming isn't that unusual that she wants to avoid other people, although that may be what's going on here. But there's other features here. But anyways, he comes to the well. He's been walking all day, it's hot, he's tired, and he sits down. This is the background now for our story. The circumstances which brought Jesus to a well of water, this is no accident. Okay? Nothing in life is an accident. Secondly, the conversation which Jesus had about another kind of water. The conversation which Jesus had about another kind of water. Now we get to the heart of the matter as we set the stage. I would have you note a number of things. First of all, in verses 7 and 8, I would have you see the initiative he took. The initiative he took. And before we get into the story, I would have you note that what Jesus does here is a great model for evangelism. You can apply these principles in any conversation or to many conversations that we might have with people who are not believers. It begins here with just simple initiative. How does evangelism begin? Sharing your faith with people? And it often begins with simply a couple of words. Just open your mouth. Start a conversation, and often the conversation simply relates around the current circumstances. And I'll leave it to you to figure out how that might apply in whatever circumstance you might find yourself. But not saying anything is not a good starter. Saying something, engaging, is a great place to begin. Sometimes as I get older, I get a little less self-conscious about things. So, you know, I'm on an elevator riding up with a bunch of people on a cruise ship. How you doing? You know, and kids get embarrassed sometimes when they were young. Dad. Maybe it's an opening here somewhere. Who knows, right? But just be friendly. Or, in Jesus' case here, simply ask questions. People often like to help you, right? How can I help? A lot of people. Anyways, that's how it begins here. A woman comes to draw water. If it's noon, maybe she's avoiding the rest of town because of the situation in which she finds herself. It's an embarrassing situation. She may be shunned. But it may be just a normal 6 o'clock in the evening occurrence. She comes to the well. Jesus knows where to find people. And he knows that this woman is going to come. He's God. He knows everything about everything you're going to do. And even the routine things in life, he's there. He asks that she get him some as well. While you're dipping, could you give me some water? Now, from a Western perspective, we go, okay, that's cool. But if you are a good Jew, this is very uncool. This is a major faux pas. You do not do this. He busts all barriers in here of gender and race. Gender. A man in that setting would be not talking to a woman by himself. That's for sure. This is not what you did. Sorry, ladies. You were not at the par of this Jewish rabbi. He would not talk to you if he was proper. But secondly, she's a Samaritan. Verse 8 actually gives us an understanding of that, where it says that Jews had no dealings with Samaritans. I already set the background in terms of what Samaria was like for the Jews. They wouldn't even walk through the territory. They were unclean. Even her pail would have been considered defiled. Who are the Samaritans? The Samaritans are a half-breed. When the northern 10 tribes of Israel were taken into exile in Assyria, the Assyrians, and there were a few left in the northern kingdom, the Assyrians sent some of their own population back to intermarry with the remnant of the Jews there. And so this was considered an impure race, as they were half-breeds, as it were. They also, as time went on, I don't have time to tell the whole story, they built their own temple because the Jews would have excluded them as being impure. They had their own ideas about religion, which was not purely Jewish. And so they were considered and treated as an alienated group. They were a group of people that were despised, that were unclean, that you had absolutely no dealings with, because they were definitely not God's people. And anything about them was defiled. And as I said, even the pail that she lets the water into would have been considered unclean. You would have not touched it. And you would have not had any dealings with these kinds of people. The rabbi said to eat bread with a Samaritan was like eating swine's flesh. They were pigs. You get the idea that they didn't really like them too much. Which says much about our Savior. And even more broadly, Christianity. I mean, the world talks about sexism and racism and all these other isms. Christ is the answer to all that stuff. Everyone is on the same level. There is no discrepancy in terms of who you are or where you've come from and your background. Before Christ, we were all at the same level. And so Christ comes into this situation and he takes the initiative to the most unlikely of people. Secondly, I would have you see the inquiry she made. The inquiry she made. Verse 9. Samaritan woman said to him, after he asked for a drink, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria?" She asked what everyone, including Jesus, knows. This is completely improper. You don't do this. But that's the point, isn't it? Jesus does what the Jews don't. One author put it this way: Jesus chose this road as a protest against their reason for not taking it. That's the very point. He comes for all people, not just a select group, not just this holy handful. I think it's very interesting when we compare this woman at the well with the character who shows up just a chapter before. And I don't think John puts them side by side without reason. Who do we read about in chapter 3? Who does Jesus have a conversation with there? Nicodemus. And here he comes to a well and he has a conversation with a Samaritan woman. Now, you could have no greater contrast between people. Nicodemus is seeking. The woman is indifferent. Nicodemus is respected. The woman is an outcast. Nicodemus is serious. The woman is flippant. Nicodemus is a Jew. The woman is a Samaritan. Nicodemus is moral. The woman is immoral. Nicodemus is orthodox. The woman is heterodox. Nicodemus is learned. The woman is ignorant. Nicodemus comes by night. The woman comes by day. Nicodemus is in Jerusalem. The woman is in Samaria. They could not have been more different. And yet they both needed Jesus. Nicodemus isn't any further ahead than the Samaritan woman. He's not at any ultimate spiritual advantage. But at the same time, Jesus isn't just concerned about the religious high and mighty for those who have a little bit of a religious tint to them. He's also concerned about those who are way out there, who are completely in another world. The inquiry she made. Thirdly, the intrigue he elicited. The intrigue she elicited. Jesus is masterful. He makes this point of contact and he turns it into a conversation about spiritual matters. He turns the corner on her. He turns her question on herself. Verse 10, Jesus answered, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." Really, it's if you really knew, it's you who should be asking me for water. He engages her to think, to wonder. You see, he's throwing the bait out there. Brilliant. I would also have you note here that Jesus is offering her a gift. If you would have known who this was, you would have asked for this gift, he says. He would have given you this gift of God, this living water. You see, the Jews believed that salvation was something that you earned. And we'll know that he's talking about salvation in just a moment. But again, he emphasizes that this is a gift. It's free. Interestingly enough, we will see here that living water is a metaphor for spiritual life. In John chapter 7, just a little bit further on in verses 37 and 38, Jesus picks up on this kind of theme and he says, "All that the Father gives me will come to me, and whoever comes to me I will never cast out. For I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me." I'm in the wrong place. Chapter 7. 37. "On the last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and cried out, 'If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scriptures have said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water.' Now this he said about the Spirit, those who believed in him were to receive." This idea of water that he would provide. And he uses this metaphor of water to apply now to the spiritual life that he would provide. And all she needs is to ask about this, and she could receive this gift of living water. You see how he's taking just an everyday, normal kind of device, a normal substance, and now he takes it and he turns it and he twists it and he applies it to himself through a question he has of her. He's enticing her. He's throwing out the bait. Verse 11, the woman said to her, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Now, sometimes that's he's kind of mocking Jesus. I'm not sure. The term you is in the first position in the sentence. You is in the emphatic. The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw or water with. The well is deep. Where do you get the living water?" It's the idea, who are you? What this is doesn't make any sense to her. Verse 12, "Are you greater than our father Jacob, he who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock?" Are you greater than Jacob? He dug this well. She's confused, but I would have you see that in her comment and in her question, she speaks the truth even though she doesn't know it. Are you greater than our father Jacob? What's the answer? Yes. That's the point. Jesus clarifies, verse 13, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never thirst again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The water he's talking about is of spiritual nature. Now, this implies something. It implies that people are thirsty and need water. Yes, we need physical water if we're to stay alive, but to live spiritually, we need this spiritual water. Now, I find it interesting that with Nicodemus, he uses the metaphor of a rebirth. Now, he uses a bit of a different metaphor with respect to this woman. He uses different metaphors in different circumstances to understand her need also for a rebirth, a filling of something that she doesn't have. We're all spiritual thirsty, he says, and I provide the water you need to fill that spiritual thirst. Someone has remarked that there's a hole in the soul that only God can fill. The God-shaped vacuum, as it were. And note here that this that he provides is eternally satisfying. You will never thirst spiritually again. Now, those are profound words. Because everyone, to one degree or another, tries to quench that spiritual thirst. Do you know that? There's that something within us that is longing for something. Viktor Frankl, a philosopher from a past age, wrote a book and he called it Man's Search for Meaning. It's within the heart of man. We are born with this seeking for purpose and meaning and for the eternal. And people try to fill it with all kinds of things. Money, sex, achievement, power, vacations, hobbies, children, family, fill in the gap. That's something that gives us purpose, gives us meaning, and I would suggest it's the dryness of the soul that people are trying to quench. And only Christ can quench that thirst. We were made for God. But they're artificial fillers. And they run out. And so we're always perpetually chasing that something. I've used the illustration before. We were on a cruise ship 6 weeks ago. Boy, I'm home now, and that will satisfy me for the rest of my life. No. Maybe okay for a little while, or whatever it may be. So then I go searching for the next cruise, and the next cruise, and the next, and the next one, and it goes on and on and on, right? Or whatever that might be. A little more money. Or the next experience with my kids. Or, but you know what I find it all disappoints. It doesn't give lasting satisfaction. Sex. See, one of the issues with pornography is that it's never enough. It's always. Only Christ can quench the thirst of the soul. And that's what he's saying to the woman. I find in today's culture, you know where I see it? In the ecology movement. No, I want to take care of the planet. So I don't throw my pop can beside in the garbage. I put it in the recycle bin. I think it's a good idea. So lest you get on me about that. But this becomes the worship of nature. Nature's God. And so people are just looking for some meaning. So you replace God with nature, and there you are. But it's a lie. It doesn't give ultimate fulfillment. People are looking for something to satisfy, that something to worship. Verse 15. She bites. Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water. Now, she doesn't understand the spiritual, but you see how he's luring her in. It's still somewhat self-centered, but the conversation is ongoing. Fourthly, the insight he displayed. And Jesus said to her, he hasn't finished reeling. Give me some of this water. Okay, let's keep the conversation going. Go call your husband and come here. Now, this is not out of the ordinary. You were to talk about these kinds of things with the husband present. But Jesus, I think, is also authenticating himself to her. How is it that he can claim to give living water? And what is that water? Now, he does this by pointing out everything about her. He points out also her sin and her need. So he's showing her who he is, and she's showing her herself. Both what her need is and his provision to meet that need, all in one sentence. He will show her he is the water that God provides that can both cleanse her sin and completely refresh her. Verse 16. Go call your husband and come here. The woman answered, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, stop. She says, I have no husband. In the Greek, that's three words. I don't have a husband. And she, you see, she, I want to talk about, I don't have a husband, and that's it. No. People don't want to talk about stuff. If it hits too close to home, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, you are right in saying I have no husband, for you've had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true. Ooh. What she tries to avoid, he won't let her avoid. He addresses the issues in our lives. Jesus knows everything. Nothing is hidden from him. But he's also the only one who can cleanse and give life where there is dearth and where there is death. You can't escape. You think there's something that God does not know about you right now? He knows everything. Where you are, what you need. He knows it all. We try to avoid it, go hide. The insight he displayed, fifthly, the intrusion she evaded. Verse 19, the intrusion she evaded. The woman said to her, said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain." She goes asking about where to worship. You must be a prophet, but let's not talk about me. Let's talk about prophetic things. Let's talk theology. You see how she's wanting to avoid the issue. Jesus points out her life, and she now rabbit trails somewhere else. You've had five husbands. In other words, you're an adulterous woman, and this is shameful. Oh, I perceive you're a prophet. Let's talk about some Bible questions. Can you help me with this? And this is not uncommon. People do not want to talk about the issues in their lives. People would rather talk about some theological question that they have. See, the issue even in talk about spiritual matters, people will want to avoid when it's about them. Then they want to talk about, well, how can God do these things to these kind of people? And often we'll go into a theological tangent to avoid the real issues of their own lives. And that's what she does. But Jesus will not be avoided. He steers it back on course. He does answer her. Without getting into the details, he's saying, actually, Jerusalem is the place that we're to worship. You guys are offside on this one. But at the end of the day, he's back to topic. Spirituality is what takes place in the heart. Spirit and truth. Not place. He doesn't leave her alone. Finally, verses 25 and 26, the information he revealed. The information he revealed. The woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming. He was called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things." Oh, he's been talking. He already brings her back to a spiritual issue. And at the end of the day, it's about spiritual things and having your heart right. And then she goes, well, yeah, we're all on the same page. He brings her back to center, to the place that they can all agree. And she says, yeah, we know about that. And I agree with you on that. And then, bingo. That's me. That's me. I'm the one who is the living water, who addresses all the issues of your heart, the Messiah, the one whom you must worship. Literally, we'll talk about this more as we go through John. He says to her, after she says, "We're expecting Messiah, we're all looking for him," he says, "I am the one speaking to you." Literally. The English misses it through its translation. He says, "I who speak to you am he." But in the original language, it's one of the "I am" statements of John. 23 times in John, this term, "I am," is used. In the Greek language, and I'll teach you a little lesson, it's two words, ego, eimi. E-G-O, ego, eimi, E-M-I. I am the one speaking to you. There are seven I am statements later on in John. I am the bread of life. I am the good shepherd. We'll talk about those. But sometimes the term is used by itself. I am, and that's it. Here he says, "I am the one speaking to you," in reference to the Messiah whom they're all waiting for. What's that about? Well, you can do your own homework, and we'll come back to it later on. But the term I am is the Greek translation of the term that God, or the burning bush, gives to Moses in the desert. When Moses confronts the fire in the bush, and God confronts him, and Moses asks, "Who is it that I should tell the Israelites, you are, what is your name?" To which God responds, "I am." The Greek translation of that phrase, "I am," in the Hebrew, Yahweh, is ego emi. What Jesus is saying here to the woman is that he is Yahweh, God, the one who can refresh the soul with living water eternally, and it's only he who can do it. So let's just move away from the woman at the well. That story continues next week. Have you drunk from the living water? Is he the one who refreshes your soul? And have you found that nothing else can do it? That's the question that is left with us from this text. I'd said earlier that we want to spend a little bit of time in prayer, and I thought it would be appropriate, we thought as a staff it would be appropriate to spend some time drinking from the fountain this morning of the water that he promises to give us. We want to spend just a few minutes in prayer between us and our Lord. Put yourself in the position of that woman who is, perhaps you're in a bad place. Perhaps you have a need. But we want to just spend some time with him. The piano will play in the background. Just you and the Lord this morning. If you have a need, I'll be available up here. Some special request, some special prayer. Elders will be available for you just for a few minutes this morning as we come to the Lord in prayer. Come to the water this morning, to the one who can refresh your soul and give you what the world cannot. Let's just be quiet before him.